Welcome to the Humans for SDGs podcast,
where we feature everyday individuals who are taking action for the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals.
These 17 Sustainable Development Goals aim to transform the world by year 2030 by eradicating poverty, protecting the environment, achieving prosperity, and ensuring peaceful and just societies through multi-sector partnerships. This podcast is brought to you by the 2030 Youth Force in the Philippines.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Humans for SDGs podcast, where we are featuring individuals who are taking action for the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. I'm your host, Rex Arevalo, and today we are featuring a very special guest. He is the director of the Apu Palamguan Cultural Education Center all the way in Bukidnon. He's also the director for research at the Institute of Environmental Science for Social Change and the global coordinator of Eco-Jesuit, Dr. Pedro Walpo.
Good to meet you this afternoon.
How was your journey like over these past, what is it now, 30 years in the Philippines? From what I know, you went to Mindanao, met the indigenous Pulangyon people in Bendum in Bukidnon. How did all of that go through? How did you meet them in the first place?
Well, life is a journey. When I'm in an area, I will walk from one village to another. I don't know if we ever realize it, but across most landscapes in the world, villages are paced. Sometimes, depending upon the environment, they're a day's journey apart. But in much of the Philippines, in the uplands, usually you can arrive at the next settlement in 3 or 4 hours, 5 or 6 hours. So I would walk from one village to another just to see what's on the land, see what's growing, meet people along the way, see their activities, and always grateful when I find a water source. Each village is connected with the next. And when you pass through one village, people will direct you to the next and give you a contact. The history of villages in Mindanao, you know, is a bit like doing archaeology. There was a generation or a layer before the present population. You can see this in how they use the land. There are different patterns on the landscape. A community has a various relationship with the land. Places don't just look cute or quaint. They have an economy, they have an ecology, and that's mediated through culture in an integrated way. So it's, as it were, obvious. Today, in most contexts, corporate agriculture determines the landscape and the ecology flows in terms of maximized market absorption, not in terms of local renewal. So you can see this in the landscape. Years ago, long time ago, I used to work in veterinary services and I used to work in national parks in Asia. And we would walk from one village to another, talking with community, engaging them where we could help. And you do one village and by the afternoon you'd walk on to another. Today, this is strange in a way because we don't have this as a way of living anymore. This connectedness. Everything is choppy. You get in a vehicle, zoom, you're on the next place. Yeah. And I think this is why people like to come to Bendum, because they come, community sees someone else, like in other times, and accepts them, opens, greets them. This is actually a very nice experience. Maybe after COVID, it's just we have so many things. We actually ignore humanity between our own personal life and our office. And that's where we cut out community. Culture is simple. It's a way of life, learning relations along the way. It's not an anthropological study, but it's a practice of being present. People who live in community, live in a culture, are present to others. Culture is also deep. It affects our sense of being, not just what we want to be or want to have, but who we are now. And these relationships are active and are the basis for forming more relationship, I suppose. We live life out in a reality, not in a dream. It's lived across the land in rural areas. It's totally different when market becomes the common denominator, and that's where everything is transacted through money, not through relations. Money has become the common denominator, and it actually determines your group, It exposes the inequalities. Very different to social integration. The difference is your trust is in the money, not in the person. I think that's what people value when they go to any rural community of their grandparents or that. Doesn't matter where I come from, people will talk to me. And I think we need that assurance again today. That's something of a journey for me.
You know, I'm just remembering my visits to Bendum over the past, 2 years now. And one thing I always tell people is every time we eat, everyone eats at the same time. There's a common call. It's like a bell and then everyone just comes together. And I think that's very valuable because, well, in modern society, so to speak, tends to be individualistic. You just go do your thing. And you mentioned over there, Pedro, the importance of relationship, being present to others, and not letting money and the market be the common denominator. I'm wondering, throughout this whole thing, you started a school there, the Apu Palamguan Cultural Education Center, and it's unique in the sense that you put an emphasis on culture and the mother tongue. Can you describe to us how you came to have this idea and how the school has changed over the years?
Well, you know, to be honest, I didn't start a school. I had a little veranda there. I had a garden. And in the evening, I would actually write letters to my mother. And the kids would come in and they would get paper and pen and scribble the same. So I started to teach them, you know, the alphabet from A to G. I think I remember I got as far as G and I said, no. I got one of the other youth in to help me. The community wanted a school. We first actually had to build a water system because people were too often sick. But we started night classes for the adults and there was basic literacy for the children. And we had a sort of a bundle of volunteers who just enjoyed being together, walking in the forest, splitting the bamboo, the wood for the walls and the roof. And we lived by the heart more than by any strategic plan. Slowly, we put a curriculum together. I actually got some textbooks from Manila, but I remember looking at them and they had all of these little stories of how to cross the road with traffic lights and a washing machine. And I thought, that really doesn't work. Our road is broken since the logging left and we hauled everything then by buffalo. And the kids really, we used to wash in the river there. And the kids really just wanted to share life. So I learned an awful lot from the kids. So I said, why don't we have enough here to learn and to teach? That's how we built up the activity, you know, the core competencies, all the technical processes of lesson planning and everything else. But we did it sort of in a learning environment of their domain, of where their ancestors are. And this way you could keep the community together because they could continue learning when they went home. They learned in their own language. And this is where I learned that reality is greater than ideas and that culture was the best guide to learning. You know, those who started with me, like Sir Jovi and Mercy, they're teachers today. They're the teachers themselves. And the students built the school. I didn't build the school. The students are professional carpenters and masons by the time they get to age 18. They speak four languages, Binulangihorn, Bisaya, Tagalog, English, and they're getting to a level that they can enter online European courses. They're pioneers in bamboo construction for Build Back Better houses that we built in Samar. They're learning and humbly, you know, they're the guardians of the resources of the nation, the biodiversity, the water, the ecological services, without any compensation or recognition. It's holistic and it's rooted. It acknowledges their identity and their sense of belonging. So that's how the school came about.
Okay, so this is great because what I'm getting here is it wasn't imposing in any way. Came over there, talked with the kids, really tried to get to know everyone. It feels like it sort of came as a natural thing rather than saying, okay, we build here, we build there. You know, a lot of youth today are also trying to be engaged in helping communities in different regions throughout the country. I'm wondering, Pedro, what are the challenges that that you have come across throughout this whole process, and what lessons or what insights do you think others could learn from your experience?
You know, the difficulty today for youth in the modern world is they come out of college and they've got to get a job. They're already caught in a pace of life. And sometimes it's very difficult, you know, for parents to understand they want to take a year off. It's not taking a year off. It's taking a year or two to go deeper into who am I after all of these 17, 18 years of education? Who am I? Where do I really want to belong? I don't ask youth today graduating what they want to be. I ask the youth today, where do you want to live? What community do you want to live in? In what context will your children meet other children? Will they grow up? And will you have a happy family? Because most are getting constricted to human silos. The youth today more than ever need this experience of the land of openness, of reduced pressures, reality, not expectation. It's wonderful to have the youth come and teach, yeah, in Bendoum, in these other places, to work on the farm. They're not taking a year off. They're going, wow, deep into who they are as persons. You see, the youth where I am, they're not competitive as they are in the city. Yeah, they want a good time. They want easy time because life isn't easy for them. They want cell phones. They want motorbikes. Yeah, they want skin whiteness to be like everybody. But in the city, they're alone. They don't belong. They don't have a place. Yeah, they want a government job because that's security. And I can then go easy from here on. But then they come back and they look for a job locally, a sense of belonging on the land and identity. Yeah, it's usually in marriage that they come to the responsibilities that they've got to take up for life. But they can do that in a sense of belonging. Life can be harsh, but if you belong, there's much consolation. Our problem is in the upper Pulangi, where the Pulangi Hun live, is that most of what's happening there is in terms of the economy. We're growing corn in the uplands. It's very destructive of the soil. Soil erosion is huge. Degraded soils. 65% of Philippines is now degraded soils. And we compensate that with chemicals. But also these chemicals are poisonous. Some of them are carcinogenic. But because people are poor, they have to eat that food rather than feed it to pigs, to feed it to Cebu or Manila or Davao. This is what's happening in the landscape. You look at the Pulangi River. It's a huge river that goes all the way to Cotabato, and it brings together all of that water, which is a national heritage. But we don't care because there's not money in that transaction. It's free, so we waste it. Yeah, and there's a point that we're getting to where the losses are going to be huge. We see that with drought. We had a drought a couple of years ago. Entire crops are lost. Our irrigation now in much of the Philippines is challenged by the unsustainability of river systems, particularly with the climatic fluxes that we're getting. Next year is supposed to be a very hot year. I'm a bit scared about that. None of our food crops will survive with those temperatures. We're really challenged to care for the land, care for the people.
So we talked about the climate over there. Now, climate change and climate action has, as I see it, been a primary concern for you for years now. I believe even in Bendoum, you're taking steps there to account for your carbon with reforestation efforts and the like. Now, you were involved, I think, 2 years ago, Pedro, in an inquiry by the Philippine Commission on Human Rights, where they looked into the possible responsibility of corporations in fueling climate change and in turn affecting the human rights of Filipinos. Am I getting this right? And how exactly is climate being connected with the human rights framework?
Yeah, I mean, I started off in COP1, 1992, in Rio, the UNFCCC, part of a team working on water globally. So water was my issue. I'd come from Bukidnon. I could see the problems. I remember when Campo Uno, when the dam was being built in Bukidnon, that famous dam in Quezon, it was still allowed to do large-scale logging in the upper watershed of that very dam. So the dam is half silted. 25 years later, it's lost most of its life capacity. We could see the problems already. You know, when I was there, I was known as Father Watershed because I this is the water source of the community and try to help them maintain it better and secure it. We built water systems from Lanao del Norte through Cotabato through many communities over the decades. So these are all what we're talking about, the basic sustainable development goals. All of this connects on three or four levels. And the most important one that we all share is this sense of citizenship, a global citizenship, a citizenship of the environment. The environment isn't out there. This is what COVID has done. The environment is in here and it's killing me at the moment if I'm not careful. We are the environment, but we make it into a dirty nest. We are the living environment and we have to learn to live in balance with everything around us. You look at what basic human rights are. None of those rights will survive if we have people dying of high temperatures during the summer. It's a basic right to be able to live in a climate that you're adapted to. Why should somebody else in the other part of the world change your climate? That's what's happening. Everything, it's like osmosis. Somehow, whatever is going on in that part of the world affects this part of the world. And what we do here affects that. So this is why I maintain, you know, we talk of two lungs, three lungs. Yes, there is the Amazon. Yes, there is the Congo region. Also Asia Pacific, from Kalimantan to the Mekong. And actually, what feeds all of that are the oceans. So, okay, without getting totally lost, come back. A human rights commission is one of the deepest and most dignified institutions a society can have. And in the Philippines, the establishment of the Commission on Human Rights through the 87 Constitution quietly sustains the most, I would call it the most secular expression of what it is to be human. In this way, it is almost a sacred secular institution, upholding the dignity of the person and of the nation. And it upholds this, espousing this dignity of the Filipino-Filipina around the world in a global context. Now, in part, you know, with the history of the Philippines, yes, we have 21 typhoons a year, but many of those typhoons are getting much more aggressive than they were before. Our coral is increasingly cooking if it's not destroyed by bad fishing. And like the 56 degrees in Mindoro the other day, we are going to suffer from temperatures. Our coastal areas are subject to sea level rise, which can be temporary and can be permanent. So the Philippines is deeply respected globally for its efforts in this area. And the Philippines is humbly leading the way to a deeper understanding of human vulnerability in the 21st century. The Philippines has, you can argue who's first in disaster, but we're pretty much there. India is a huge disaster in terms of internal migration today and the vulnerability. What COVID did, everything that's happening at the moment, exposes vulnerability of the human population, by which we have to be compassionate, not judgmental. That's what's happening humanity the world over. The same way the world over, we're seeing, okay, beautiful things happening in nature, but that's short-lived. We now also have to be compassionate and caring for the land and the seas and the airs. You really want to go back to this dirty air in Manila? When you come from the provinces, you choke on the air here. Your life expectancy, I am quite sure, in some scientific paper is established and identified that your life expectancy in Manila is reduced by a couple of years because of the pollution. That's true. I used to measure it in Marikina with the sicknesses. Every time there was an inversion of cold air above the hot industrial air in Marikina, all of the bronchial sicknesses would come out in the health centers. So we have to shift in this. So it is a human right to have a stable climate. And the Philippines is one of the great learning areas. It's not a hermeneutical argument by which we debate climate change, whether it exists or not. It's here, our people are suffering, we're making a global appeal. And the commission is one of the most humble and genuine institutions that brings this out to other institutions across the world. Not in judgment, but as an appeal. that personally we change our lifestyles and globally we change our economies. We need a revision of how we're doing things. Now is an opportunity to regenerate our economies, our lives differently. So I ask you, in one sense, what are you willing to do personally? What choice are you going to make and say, well, I'm not going to do this anymore or this? And it will come from you. It won't be a requirement as in a checklist, but it'll come from your lifestyle. How are you going to redefine your lifestyle in this post-COVID situation? And what do you really want as a relationship? Is it always through money and borakai? Or live life on the land in a much more integral way, respectful and communicative way? We really have to invest in agriculture. There's no investment in the small farmer. Bank loans are not attainable as it's done. Many people are not recognized. They always have to barter their land rights for getting the right papers. I think we have to have a much more supportive policy system of farmers, small fishermen, of the land and of the Philippines, all of the islands of the Philippines. I think that that's where the challenge is, to go with hope and trust, but with a firm grasp of reality, not simply a technical solution to an interim problem. We don't need technology. What we need is human commitment to resolve most of these. Distribute food. I mean, we saw the food problems here. How do we get those 17 sustainable goals? They divide up, you know, into agricultural and food systems, in a sense, is at the top of it. You know, prosperity, but equality, equity in that prosperity, people and dignity and justice. That's what education, hunger, all of these is about. And then again, the planet and citizenship. You know all of that.
Okay, Pedro, that was a lot, but it's also a lot that we need to understand and we need to really reflect on. It's funny, you know, I was, when we were starting this podcast, it was about, okay, who's doing something for SDG1, who's doing something for SDG2? And then when I was inviting you, I said, maybe he's doing something for a little bit of all 17 SDGs. Because really, that's the message I feel coming from this, where it does have to be integral. There's no other way of going about it. So thank you, Pedro. I hope that everyone here has some nugget of wisdom, some nugget of insight to gain, and we'll see you all next time.
Remember, it starts with you, and hold the reality and we'll get there. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Humans for SDGs podcast. This has been Brex Arevalo. Please tune in to our next episode where we will be featuring more individuals who are taking action for the UN SDGs.
This podcast is brought to you by the 2030 Youth Force in the Philippines. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/YouthForcePH.